Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is New York Times best-selling writer Jonathan Tropper, author of This Is Where I Leave You and One Last Thing Before I Go. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We had our 10th anniversary show of Two Jewish last night, starring Robert Klein, and it was a great evening. After 10 years of Two Jewish, wonderful guests, excellent varied music, and really old jokes, we had the opportunity to do a 90-minute live broadcast with the great comedian Robert Klein. It was quite the event, and if you missed it last night, you can hear it on our website starting this week. A truly amazing experience for all concerned, if I do say so myself. Some people think we should make this an annual event. Wow, I don't know, but I promise we'll do it at least every 10 years. I have to admit that as great as I feel today about our 10th anniversary celebration last night, and as optimistic as I generally feel about the wonderful country of Israel, the political news from there is inspiring something less than great pride and confidence in this particular rabbi. When last we left our heroes in the Israeli Knesset, after some surprising and refreshing results in the Israeli elections, two new parties, Yesh Atid under Yair Lapid and Bayit HaYehudi under Naftali Bennett, had agreed to work together to try to move the Israeli political world from its dependence on the religious parties and their stranglehold over many aspects of Israeli society. But with word this week that Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has made a deal with Tzipi Livni's smallish Tenua party, and that he is now about to make a deal with the Sephardic religious party Shas, and form a coalition that will likely include another religious party and a small centrist party, and will then arm-twist Naftali Bennett into becoming part of a very large coalition, it looks like real economic and social reform may end up getting backburnered yet again by internal Israeli political maneuverings. Yeesh. Sometimes it seems as though Israel's politics are just as screwed up as America's. In happier news, we are now moving into the season best called the pre-Passover preparation period, also known as Seder is coming and we better get on it. Technically speaking, we have another week and a half before the Purim month of Adar is finished. But in the rolling thunder of the Jewish calendar, Purim is always exactly a month before Pesach, and no holiday requires more advanced preparation and thought than Passover. A month scarcely seems like enough, to be honest. So while some of us are still shaking the hamantaschen crumbs from our tablecloths, it's actually time to begin to think about the Festival of Freedom and who we might invite for Seder and how to do a real spring cleaning in our homes. And so to play us in on this fine, not quite spring morning, here's a bit of our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music from the folk rock band Safam for the upcoming festival, Adir Hu, God is Lord, from the Passover Seder.
Oh,
That was Safam singing Adir Hu for the coming Festival of Passover, beginning 3 weeks from Monday night on the evening of March 25th. When we come back on Too Jewish This Morning, we'll meet our guest, Jonathan Tropper, all of whose protagonists are men struggling to find their way through crisis in very funny ways. Find out what makes him a best-selling novelist and perhaps the hottest writer in America today when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Jonathan Tropper, the international best-selling author of 6 novels. Plan B, The Book of Joe, Everything Changes, How to Talk to a Widower, This Is Where I Leave You, and One Last Thing Before I Go. His books have been translated into more than 20 languages. This Is Where I Leave You, which he adapted as a feature film for Warner Brothers, is going to start shooting soon. Jonathan is adapting the New York Times bestseller, One Last Thing Before I Go, his book, for J.J. Abrams and Paramount Pictures. He's the co-creator and executive producer of the TV show Banshee. And he lives in Westchester, New York, with his 3 children. And how do you do all of that?
Yeah, I just got tired listening to you read it.
Really?
First of all, you know, it all sort of happens at the same time, but you're not working. You know, that's years of work that have all just kind of been sort of hitting at the same time, but I obviously wasn't doing them all at the same time. Still, at any given time, I'm generally, you know, writing a book, running the television show, and involved in some kind of feature film work. So, you know, on the plus side, I really enjoy being able to diversify myself creatively like that. I've just sort of had to give up eating and sleeping.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Well, you know, everybody's an overnight sensation after years of effort. Your background is unusual for a best-selling novelist, raised modern Orthodox, Yeshiva University. How many New York Times best-selling authors actually got their degrees from Yeshiva University?
Oh, I've never thought to look into that. I've never looked. I'm sure I'm not the only one. And, I will tell you that, you know, when I went there, they had a pretty good English Lit department.
In your books, you often use really interesting, first of all, you use Jewish elements in very interesting ways. You use a shiva really as a kind of a literary vehicle. B'nai Mitzvah show up in important ways. Is that intentional or it just kind of happens?
In my earlier books, really I would say my first 4 books, I kept the Jewish content down to, you know, almost none. I never, in most cases, even identified characters as Jewish. I had this notion in my head as a younger writer that I wanted to make my name as an American writer and not get pigeonholed as a Jewish writer. Ironically, of course, This Is Where I Leave You, which was the first book where I really just brought in Jewish themes in a very overt way. That was my first book to really become a huge bestseller. So I guess there's a lesson in there somewhere. I'm just not sure what it is. But, This Is Where I Leave You did not start out to be a book about a shiva. It started out to be a book about a man who is stripped of all the things that he feels makes him a man. and how he climbs his way back up. And, you know, so it's this man whose wife cheats on him with his boss, so he loses his job, he loses his marriage, he loses his home, and he's pretty much left with nothing. And I was writing the book, and I was about 100 pages in, and it just wasn't working for me. And then I wrote a chapter where he goes back to see his family, and the family really brought the book to life for me, and I had to come up with a way to give the book to the family. But I needed a plot device that would keep this guy with this crazy family for more than an hour. And that's when the idea of a Shiva occurred to me. And so I converted the family to Judaism, and I made the book about a Shiva.
It's a terrific book. We will talk much more with author Jonathan Tropper when we come back this morning on Too Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. You can also attend the Brandeis Book and Author events and meet writer Jonathan Tropper, our guest this morning. This coming Wednesday night and lunchtime Thursday, call Sheila Rothenberg at 232-9559,
232-9559, or go to the Brandeis website, TucsonBNC.org. Should be a great program. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy, good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, theater in Israel has been an important part of the state since the Yeshuv days, since before it was a state. Habima, the National Theater of Israel, was founded. Jews have always been artistic and very theatrical. You could make a case that most of American theater in the 20th century was Jewish. Talk a little bit about what theater in Israel is like.
Well, I would want to give an example, because there's a lot of types of theaters in Israel. But I think that in order to really understand the theater in Israel and the culture, we need to look not at the mainstream theater, but on the off-stage...
The off-Broadway version of Israeli theater.
Exactly. So just recently, on February 22nd, for about a week, there was an amazing theater festival called Klipa Aduma. Klipa Aduma, to explain a little bit, is a tweak of words from the phrase Kippa Aduma, which is Little Red Riding Hood.
Or Little Red Riding Hood, right.
Little Red Riding Hood. Right. And as you said, Kippa comes from the word Yarmulke. Klipa is a tweak of those words, and it has two meanings. One is a shell that have a lot of Kabbalistic meanings and so on and so forth, but also a metaphor for something empty. But the other is klipa as the feminine version of klip, which is a video clip. And the Klipa Aduma Festival was an international festival of very modern, avant-garde, I might say. You can call it theater shows, although it's not only theater, because it's a combination. It's a combination of all the visual arts, theater, films, dancing, other forms of arts, all combined on one stage and sometimes off the stage, sometimes with engagement with the audience, in a very modern, very different type of art than what we used to see. And I think that in a nutshell, that brings a lot of the story of the theater in Israel today. Because while we still have the big institutional theaters like Hakamari and Habima, which are the equivalent probably to Broadway or whatever.
Or yeah, the more serious, you know, the National Theater or something like that, right?
Right.
The Royal Shakespeare Company of Israel.
Exactly. We do see an amazing phenomenon of emerging more and more smaller theaters that are more experimental, more innovative, very different. To some people, that might make sense when they think of the startup element of Israel, this entrepreneurial culture. And it's very interesting. There is a vivid and thriving theater scene, mainly in Tel Aviv, but also at Haifa, at Be'er Sheva, in Jerusalem, that brings all those threats together, the Jewish identity and culture and the Israelity and the international perspective and modern arts, all in one shell. It's amazing. It's a blast.
Thanks, Guy. A vibrant, wonderful theater scene in Israel. Yet another thing to be grateful for. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our poetry slam this week for the gradually approaching holiday of Passover comes from Marge Piercy. It's called Saltwater. It's a bowl of tears on the table into which we dip the parsley, into which we dip the egg. It's a miniature ocean on the table, salt as the sea of reeds through which they were to pass, not to safety, never safety, but to where they were promised they would, if they chose, be free. It is the salt water of our sweat, pressed through our skin as the body labors, for we are bidden not only to rest on the seventh day, but to work on the others. And the brain, too, in its fever of creation, exudes salt like the sea, salt like our blood, salt like the waters of the womb, the salt of regret and the salt of effort. That was Marge Piercy's poem for the Seder table. The first Seder is 3 weeks from tomorrow night, Monday, March 25th, and it's called Saltwater.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We have been exploring the relationship between the diaspora and Israel historically and in contemporary times. Let's do a kind of a huge period of time. Everything that happened in relationship with the diaspora and Israel from, the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 or so.
Right. So around that time, there were many, many Jewish sects competing for attention and resources in the land of Israel and in the diaspora. One of those sects evolved into Christianity. Several of them disappeared. Some remain as tiny minority sects of like weird offbeat Jews like the Karaim or whatever,
Karaites,
who are
right.
Tiny.
Well, they weren't always tiny.
Right, but now they are.
Yep.
But mainstream Jewry from the period that we're talking about now, the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70, until some point in the 19th century, was de facto, if not de jure, all Orthodox. And they all lived by the same set of laws, which emerged during exile. I mean, the Babylonian Talmud was codified in what is today Iraq, much later than the destruction of the Second Temple, slightly earlier, the Mishnah, which is the core of the Talmud, and a lot of many people view the rest of Talmud as commentary on Mishnah, and Mishnah was commentary on Torah, right? That was written down and codified sometime around the end of the second century or very early third century, which is around the same time that the New Testament was finally written down, and there was sort of a new Bible for a new Israel, which is how the Christians saw themselves. But there was also this new written code for Jewish life, which is how the rabbis saw the Mishnah. And it was a way of guiding Jewish life in the diaspora and of applying the laws of Moses and the revelation at Sinai to unforeseeable situations that occurred over 1,000 years or 1,500 years after Sinai itself. So Jews proceeded to spread out over much of the known world, certainly all through the Roman Empire and quite a few other places as well, and then developed even more commentary and institutions. You know, the great medieval commentators like Rashi and Maimonides and all these guys lived either in the Muslim world in North Africa or in Spain, or in the Christian world in Europe.
And probably couldn't have done what they did had they been living in a Jewish enclave in Israel. I mean, there was something about the richness of these diverse cultures that gave them additional inspiration to write these.
Right. It was their interaction with the Christian world. It was being a minority. It was struggling
with
existential questions of how do we maintain our identity outside of Israel, outside the obligations spelled out in Torah in terms of the temple and the pilgrimages and the sacrifice. What do we do instead?
Right.
And how do we react to oppression, victimization, stereotypes, whatever? All this created at different points in Jewish history different types of responses, but one could even argue that the flourishing of Jewish art, music, etc., at the end of 19th century Europe was a response to a new kind of anti-Jewish pressure, and it was a response. It was a way of dealing artistically and creatively with the angst created by living in an age when anti-Semitism became actually a political party in Austria, Germany, etc., etc.
Fascinating. So, in an interesting sort of way, the diaspora has kept us alive, kept us vibrant, and encouraged the tremendous outpouring of Jewish creativity throughout history.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Levine stops at the cathedral to visit his friend, Father O'Reilly, who is hearing confession. Suddenly, the priest is called away for an emergency. Not wanting to leave the confessional unattended, he asks Rabbi Levine to cover for him. Rabbi says, I don't know what to do. But the priest tells him, just listen to the next confession and do the same thing the priest does. So, the rabbi comes into the confessional with the priest, and in a few minutes, a woman comes in and says, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. I committed adultery. The priest says, how many times? The woman says, three times. The priest says, okay, say three Hail Marys, put $25 in the collection box, and sin no more. This I can do, the rabbi thinks. Okay, I got it. Go to your emergency, he tells Father O'Reilly. A few moments later, a man enters the confessional. He says, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. Rabbi Levine says, what did you do? The man says, I committed adultery. Rabbi asks, how many times? The man replies, three times. The rabbi says, okay, say three Hail Marys, put $25 in the collection box, and sin no more. Then a woman enters and says, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. The rabbi says, what did you do? The woman replies, I committed adultery. The rabbi asks, how many times? The woman says, once. Rabbi Levine is startled. He doesn't have an answer. But, resourcefully, thinking quickly, he says, we have a special this week. Go do it two more times and come back. Three for $25. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's double portion of Vayakhel Pekudei, the conclusion of the book of Exodus, deals with the creation and completion of the tabernacle in the wilderness, the consecration of the first central worship sanctuary for the people of Israel. Vayakhel et ha'am, the text begins, Moses assembles the people, calls them together, and asks them on God's behalf to bring forward the finest objects they possess to help create a tabernacle in which the whole people can worship God in holiness. And the people bring the best they have, gold and silver, precious stones and materials, to create a beautiful sanctuary, one they can be proud of and one which they believe will lend itself to the perpetuation of beauty and sanctity. Then Moses invites these artisans, wise in the ways of working with beautiful items, to come forward, create a structure that embodies what God sees as appropriate for a sanctuary. In particular, Moses explains that God has called by name a man named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, whom God filled with the Spirit of the Lord in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and all manner of skilled workmanship, filled with the wisdom of the heart, that he might teach and work with every wise-hearted person in this sacred work. When the work is complete, they have created a tabernacle into which God immediately brings the Shekhinah, the divine presence, a place of profound sacredness for our ancestors. I love that phrase for those skilled in the work of the hands, wise-hearted men and women who can create beauty and elegance to serve God in this world. You know, each of us has different skills. Some sing, some dance, some speak eloquently, and some of us create works of art and practical beauty with our hands. Each of us can contribute to the creation of holiness in this world by applying these skills to holy work. When we do, we too have the potential to bring God's presence into our midst, into our ordinary, practical world, and so make it sacred. May we each use our own skills this week to make our lives and our world a little holier. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll talk with our guest, Jonathan Tropper, the author of six novels, two of them runaway bestsellers, screenwriter of the adaptation of his own book, five of them have been optioned for films already, and the co-creator of a new TV series, Banshee. Coming from a modern Orthodox background, how does he do all of this? Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
It was a light news week, and we have a lot of light news of Jews today. First, Ali Reisman, the Jewish gymnast who won three medals at last summer's London Olympics, is joining the celebrity cast of ABC's Dancing with the Stars. Maybe it's Dancing with the Stars of David this time? Reisman was among the cast revealed by Good Morning America last week for the show's 16th season, which begins March 18th. Others include former figure skating champion Dorothy Hamill, another Olympic gold medalist. Reisman rose to fame last summer with her gold medal in the floor routine, performing to the Jewish classic Hava Nagila and helping the U.S. women's team take gold. The Massachusetts native also said she supported a moment of silence for the 11 Israeli Olympians killed at the Munich Games in 1972. In Israel, Yitish Einah, a former Israeli army officer, became the first Ethiopian Israeli to win the Miss Israel pageant. Panel of judges awarded the title to Einah, a 21-year-old model who came to Israel about 10 years ago. It's important that a member of the Ethiopian community wins the competition for the first time, she said. There are many different communities of many different colors in Israel, and it's important to show that to the world. Einah came to Israel with her family when she was 12. Acclimating to Israel was difficult at first, Einah said, but she picked up the language with the help of a friend. She's been working as a salesperson since her army discharge. During the competition, Einah cited American civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. as one of her heroes. He fought for justice and equality, and that's one of the reasons I'm here. I want to show that my community has many great qualities that aren't always represented in the media, she said. And in other news, the Oscars were last weekend, and while there wasn't anything stunningly more Jewish about this year's awards than usual, maybe even a little less so, there was both a surprisingly Jewish backstory and a bit of controversy.
Nobody will go, sir. If it's not kosher, then no show, sir. Even Goyim won't be dim enough to choose. Put on shows that make men stare with lots of girls in underwear. You may even have the finest of reviews.
You're doing great!
But the audiences won't care, sir, as long as you don't dare, sir, to open up on Broadway.
If we don't have any Jews.
First, the positive backstory. Daniel Day-Lewis, who picked up the Oscar as Best Actor for his portrayal of Abraham Lincoln last week. That was his third victory as Best Actor at the Academy Awards, by the way. Daniel Day-Lewis is the son of Irish Protestant poet laureate Cecil Day-Lewis. But Day-Lewis's mother is Jewish actress Jill Balcon, who was herself the daughter of Sir Michael Balcon, the head of the British Ealing Studios in its heyday, producing hit films. Sir Michael, son of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, married South African-born Aileen Leatherman. Their daughter Jill was not brought up with much Judaism, and her children, including Daniel Day-Lewis, didn't have a Jewish dimension to their childhood. In fact, Day-Lewis recalls that despite regularly visiting his grandparents as a child, he did not hear Hebrew or Yiddish being used until he was 18 years old. So, Daniel Day-Lewis is halachically Jewish, if not actually so. Still, we'd kind of like to claim him, especially as he keeps on winning Oscars.
On the downside of the Oscar telecast, kind of, Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy in the movie Ted, who hosted the Oscars, wrote a skit for actor Mark Wahlberg and the CGI animated stuffed bear who starred with him in the comic film Ted. The skit, which was about as funny as Family Guy, which you either love or loathe, took a turn to the disturbing when the bear, Ted, tried to get Mark Wahlberg to say that he was Jewish, which he is not, so that he would stand a better chance of continuing to work in Hollywood. Here's the shtick that brought on the ire of the ADL, among others concerned about anti-Semitism.
There's Daniel Day-Lewis, there's Alan Arkin, there's Joaquin Phoenix. And you know what's interesting? All those actors I just named are part Jewish.
Oh, okay.
What about you? You got a Berg on the end of your name. Are you Jewish?
Am I Jewish? No, actually, I'm Catholic.
Wrong answer. Try again.
What?
Look, you want to work in this town or don't you? That's interesting, Mark, because I am Jewish.
No, you're not.
I am. I was born Theodore Shapiro, and I would like to donate money to Israel and continue to work in Hollywood forever. Thank you. I am Jewish.
You're an idiot.
Yeah, well, we'll see who the idiot is when they give me my private plane at the next secret synagogue meeting.
So here's the thing. While this was borderline anti-Semitic, it would be pretty disingenuous to pretend that Jews are not extremely prominent in Hollywood. In fact, since we invented the whole movie industry, and since Jews have headed most of the major studios since the creation of motion pictures, the element of truth within MacFarlane's lame attempt at humor makes it a bit less idiotic. And Jews are everywhere in Hollywood. Humor has been around for a very long time, and sometimes it's more acceptable. It just has to actually be funny. 3 years ago, Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin did a shtick that was well worth enjoying.
In Inglourious Bastards, Christoph Waltz played a Nazi obsessed with finding Jews. Well, Christoph, the motherlode.
So I guess the truth is that what really matters is not whether you make fun of the prevalence of Jews in show business, but whether or not you do so with actual good humor and some modicum of taste, as, say, Monty Python did.
There's a very small percentile who enjoys a dancing Gentile. I'm sad to be the one with this bad news. But never mind your swordplay, you just won't succeed on Broadway. You just don't succeed on Broadway if you don't have any Jews.
And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We're delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, author Jonathan Troppers, an international best-selling author of 6 novels, Plan B, The Book of Joe, Everything Changes, How to Talk to a Widower. This is where I leave you, and one last thing before I go. Jonathan, we were talking about, this is where I leave you earlier on the show, talking about the use of the Shiva and how really that book took off. Do you think it was because you went back to your sort of Jewish roots?
I've thought about it a lot, and of course I can never really know, but my feeling is that's not really, it's not really related to that. I'm sure many more Jewish people who maybe hadn't heard of me before heard of me because people were talking about this novel about, you know, that's set during a Shiva. It's kind of an unusual thing, but I think it was really just the culmination of sort of all the books I'd written before it, and switching to a new publisher that gave me a more aggressive publication, and just kind of, writing the right book at the right time. And, you know, I'm sure that the authenticity of a Jewish family that I was able to bring to it enhanced the book, but whether or not that is the thing that launched it, you know, I don't think, if you could quantify that stuff, they would bottle it and do it every time, you know?
Absolutely. You worked in your family's business, doing marketing, writing press releases, and so on. And you've written or talked about how your Zadie was still going to the office in his late 90s. What did your family think about your shift to becoming a novelist?
They were fine with it. I mean, they were very encouraging and supportive of it. My parents are intellectuals and big readers, and I have a brother who's a professor and does a different kind of publishing, and they were very supportive of it. I have a lot of relatives, so there's no shortage of people to go into the business.
Your novels highlight men in crisis, for want of a better term, guys dealing with really traumatic experiences, life-threatening diseases, loss of their profession, dissolution of marriages.
why the focus on this, or why has this seemed to come out as your central theme?
You know, I'm sure it's a little bit of function of my background. You know, I grew up in a middle-class Jewish home, and, you know, on the one hand, we're not dealing with, you know, issues of, you know, I never really worried where my next meal was coming from or, you know, things like that. And, you know, to me, I was always just fascinated, I guess, with the overall theme of, you know, what it is that makes us men today, just, you know, across a wide spectrum of, you know, of socioeconomic places. You know, the way we are men today is different from the way men were men 30 years ago, and I'm just, you know, fascinated at kind of this extended adolescence that today's men seem to go through, and, you know, the fact that ultimately you pay the price for that and you come of age at a later point than you should have, which often leads to a very large crisis.
The midlife crisis, that maybe it's really not so much a midlife crisis, it's what used to be an earlier life crisis, figuring things out, now it just happens later.
Yeah, I think people are so, and men in particular, are so focused on staying young and holding on to their youth and not putting childish things away. And then, you know, either we follow a script that we've just not really thought through, or we, you know, whatever happens, we wake up one day and realize that we've forgotten to grow up, even though we're adults. And when that has to happen very quickly, usually because of a traumatic event, it's often difficult and also funny as hell sometimes. So.
And your books are funny. Tell us what it's like adapting a book for the film industry. You know, every author has a different experience. You're fairly new in this experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, five of my books have been optioned for films, but, you know, the first three of those were adapted by other people and never made it to the screen. And so I decided, you know, at that point, you know, I'd gotten a little bit of experience with screenwriting. I decided I was going to try myself. And it has not been an easy process, both on the writing side, you know, taking a book that you spent a year writing and sort of tearing it apart and putting it back together differently for a film is just a very painstaking and not often pleasant process. And then, you know, pushing it through the studio system, pushing the kind of stuff I write through the studio system is extremely difficult, in that none of my characters are superheroes. And so it's been a long ordeal. It's been about 4 years of writing and rewriting and different drafts for different actors and different directors and different budgets. Happy to say that we're just a few months away from beginning production, so I'm excited about it.
We will pray for its continuation in the process and its success, because I know it can be a really dicey process. You're also doing TV now. How does that differ?
Yeah, the reason I went to television is right now television is really a writer's medium. On the movie side, you write your screenplay, but then it really belongs to the director. In television, you know, it belongs to the writer, and the directors come in and direct particular episodes of your show, but you are, you know, it's the writer who oversees the overall tone and continuity of the show. So it's a great time to be writing television. There's a lot of places to sell television now, and you know, they're very hungry for content. And the production schedule is just so much faster. You know, once you're in production, you can be writing stuff on Monday that they're shooting on Tuesday, so it's an extremely fulfilling process to be writing stuff and getting it produced and on the screen so quickly.
Did anybody in adapting, This Is Where I Leave You, anybody ever say that it was too Jewish or try to make it a non-Jewish story?
Nobody said that. You know, my director on the film is Sean Levy, who himself is Jewish, and, you know, there was definitely a sense, which is the same sense I had in writing the book, that this has to appeal to a universal audience. I can't make this an inside Jewish film that won't appeal to anyone else. So there was always a sense that these have to be people that we relate to. And, you know, this is certainly not a religious family by any stretch. And it's a family that barely knows it's Jewish and I think would identify itself much more as an American family than a Jewish family. And, you know, the nice thing both, you know, about the book was, you know, in the 4 years since the book is out, I get letters from people of all religions and no religions just telling me how this family is the same as their family. Hmm. So I think the goal was just the same with the movie, to make sure it stayed really universal and accessible as a story about a family and about a marriage, and not not about, you know, a Jewish story.
In one last thing before I go, what's your favorite book, I guess, is how I would ask. It seems to me that that's you're growing through the course of writing. I would hope every author tries to do that. What's your favorite of the books you've written?
Yes, I mean, I think every author always feels their most recent book is their best work. You know, I happen to have a really soft spot for a book I wrote a while back called Everything Changes, and in some ways that book, to me, will always be my favorite. But, you know, you're always the most excited about your most recent book because you feel you've kind of taken yourself to a new place as a writer.
What authors influenced you the most?
When I was in high school, I read a ton of Stephen King and Kurt Vonnegut Jr., almost exclusively those two, and wanted to write like them. When I was in college, someone gave me a copy of Bright Lights, Big City by Jay McInerney.
I thought you were going to say that. I'm not sure why, but I...
But that book really sort of, that's where the light bulb went off, and I kind of began to understand the kind of novels I wanted to write. That was really sort of my big watershed book. You know, currently I'm a big fan of writers like Richard Russo, Michael Chabon, Jonathan Lethem, writers like that.
What's your next book going to be about?
I'm just really putting that together now. It's probably not at a stage yet where I could articulate it in any kind of articulate fashion.
How do you decide what you're going to write about next?
I usually... At any point I'm writing a book, a lot of other things come up that aren't right for that particular book, but I sort of put those ideas aside somewhere in my brain, and you know, there's always a handful of characters that are sort of percolating, and at some point one of them kind of, you know, comes into focus for me, or I force it into focus, and I try to decide if there's a story to tell there.
Hemingway once said that writing wasn't hard, you just had to sit at a typewriter until blood came out of your forehead. Is writing a difficult process for you? Is it enjoyable?
I think like a lot of writers, I very much prefer having written to the actual writing. But there is, I do get a tremendous sense of excitement and discovery when the writing's going well, and you know, you're writing, you know, sentence after sentence that you feel good about and is gelling for you, and you feel like, you know, the same way you feel when you're playing a musical instrument or doing anything, you know, artistic, that you're actually generating something from nothing. And it's a very good feeling when it's working.
When you write about a guy in crisis, it just seems like all of your guys are trying to figure out, as you said, what it means to be a man today. How close do they get?
Well, nobody really wants to read about people who have it all figured out. Not really very interesting.
No, there's not a lot of reality TV shows about perfect lives out there. And great literature somehow doesn't turn out to be about polished, wonderful things. How close are these characters to your life?
I think they could all exist in the world I live in, but I never base characters on actual people or you know, people I've met or people I've experienced or, you know, or myself. Obviously, my opinions, and there's an emotional truth to everything I write, and obviously, you know, the things I've gone through and the things I experience are going to come out in these characters. So I guess there's some sort of emotional truth to them that comes from me, but and all these people could exist in the world I live in. They're not supernatural or hyper real people, but you know, at the same time, none of them really come from my life.
Do you ever see yourself leaving New Rochelle and moving to Hollywood?
I'm actually doing this interview from Hollywood right now, but I much prefer being a frequent visitor here. I like living in on the East Coast.
Does it keep you close to your roots?
Yeah, and you know, I'm not going to uproot my kids, and that's just, sure. You know, it just feels like, you know, I just feel like I belong there.
I want to thank Jonathan Tropper for a great interview here on Too Jewish. You can hear him this coming week in Tucson. You'll hear more about that in another part of the show. Jonathan, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Ann Kirshner, author of The Lady at the OK Corral, the true story of Josephine Marcus Earp. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music on the fun CD Reggae Passover, L'Shana Haba'ah, Next Year in Jerusalem, the traditional conclusion to the Seder. It's now 3.5 weeks before Passover, which begins March 25th. And please be sure to attend the Brandeis Author Event featuring our guest this morning, Jonathan Tropper, among other fine writers. It's coming up Wednesday night and lunchtime Thursday. Call Sheila Rothenberg at 232-9559, 232-9559, or go to the Brandeis website, TucsonBNC.org. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
L'shana haba'a, l'shana haba'a, l'shana haba'a b'Yerushalayim.
Sure.